I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they make and the poems they love.
Poetry's about anarchy, it's about mystery, it's about dreams, it's about, you know, the unknown.
I made myself anew in poetry.
The poem invites the world to come celebrate.
This is Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, and I'll be reading my poem, The First Checkup After My Mother Died, from my book, How to Love the Empty Air. The doctor notices me fidgeting with my ears, like a toddler, and asks if he could look at them. Yes, I tell him. They had been bothering me, and I didn't know why. After the examination, he asks if I've been through something traumatic recently, a breakup or a loss of a job. Yes, I tell him, not wanting to explain. How did you know? Well, he tells me, this type of infection is common among people who have gotten in the pattern of holding back tears. If you don't allow those tears to drain the way they're supposed to, they stay inside, cause a lot of pain. Do you think this is what's happening to you? He asks. Yes, I nod and hold back my tears.
That's just such a beautiful poem. And the book, too, is centered around the death of your mother.
Yes.
And so, first of all, I just have to ask, is that, I hate this question because I, too, am a poet and people ask me this all the time, but is that true about the holding their tears?
Yeah. That is true.
That is true.
Yeah. I had to stop performing this poem while I was on the Midwest leg of my poetry tour because I got double ear infections. And
because
my touring partner was like, you do know that you are touring with a poem about getting ear infections by holding back tears, and you're reading about it and holding back your tears, and now you have ear infections. Like, everyone's very concerned. I was like, I should just cut out the middleman and not perform this poem.
Will the circle
anymore.
Be unbroken here?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah. You know, my work, this is my seventh collection of poetry. One of the things that has always attracted me in writing is taking small moments and sort of teasing them out for their larger purpose. And those moments happen so much in life, and people kind of skip over them. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the joys I have as a writer is finding those moments that are so ironic or heartbreaking that you tend to just sort of skip over and mm-hmm. kind of shine a spotlight. And in that moment, you know, when I went to the doctor, I was like, this is not something I really want to share. I just want to get my checkup and, like, get out of here. Mm-hmm. And so in holding back that information and him saying, or have you been holding back tears? You just had to, like, not have a breakdown. And it just, writing poetry at that time period was like the last thing I wanted to do. Because throughout my career as a poet, I just used poetry to sort of pin to the page the things I wanted to remember. And I wanted to remember none of these experiences. Mm-hmm. But it was incidents like that that would just rattle through my head. And I couldn't get to sleep or do anything else until I just put it to the page and could stare at it and know it was real. And then sort of walk away and continue living.
Right. That experience of processing an event in life at the same time that you're creating. It's like, you know, processing something so that it can sort of move past you or you can move through it. But at the same time, you're kind of constructing this piece of art.
Right.
You're building something as at the same time that something is being deconstructed.
Yeah.
The reality of having that person with you.
Yeah.
And I think that is a remarkable quality. I don't know that many people can so easily do that. And it does seem like it's like your writer sense, right? It's like people have different coping mechanisms. And you're like trying to resist your ultimate coping mechanism, right? Like, no, I'm not going to write about this.
And to me, you know, so much of my poetry for me is like a puzzle, especially as I grew older. I always say my younger poetry was not just like, this is a love poem, but like, this is a poem I'm writing specifically so that you, Jason, will fall in love with me, you know? Like, they were all very directive and like had an object to them. And then And then as I grew older, you know, poetry became this way of being like, why am I fixated on this? Let me work this poem through and see what it can show me about myself. And so for this time period, it was like, I knew all the answers. Like, my mom was dead and I was sad. Like, there's no figuring it out. So like, why spend any energy capturing this when all I wanted to do was like, get through it and forget it. But it was writing about grief that brought me the most comfort, and reading about grief, and then sort of this unconscious writing where I would just do it so that I could stop obsessing about it. That was sort of the birth of this book.
Yeah. And it feels very, the book as a reader, the experience of the book is very complicated. And part of what I really enjoyed about it was the speaker resisting the complication of it, and then inevitably being not able to resist it and entering into it, right? Like, there are some poems that sort of say just that. Like, what is the use?
Right.
What is the use of this?
Right.
And as the reader, you're it's almost like you're like, oh, please don't stop now. You know, you're like, let's just keep going because we're with you in the process, you know. And there's this sort of like sleight of hand that the speaker seems to be doing with herself throughout the book. Like, I'm not going to write about this, or what is the use of writing about this? This isn't going to yield anything, for example, like my mother.
Right, yeah.
Being not dead.
And my mother and I were very close, and in it I talk a lot about her being sort of a narrator of my life, which is definitely something that I carry in to my parenting style, where she would always, I would go through something and then she would retell me what I just went through. And make myself the hero of the story. So even if I had been teased or didn't do well or something, she always reframed it so that it was like I was heroic and brave and, you know, spunky. And that happened throughout my entire life. And so to have that missing, it was like, well, who am I writing this book for? Like, who's going to tell me the worth of this book if this narrator is now gone? And so the book is a struggle with that. And in touring behind it, I didn't realize the vulnerability of that, putting the book out and sharing it with people. And famously, I toured with people, pressmates. And Derek Brown also, he's the publisher of this book, also had a book coming out. And our first event, I was so nervous because I had not read any of these poems out loud. And I tried rehearsing them at home and just ended up like on the floor sobbing with my dachshunds, like, whoa. And I was like, this has got to be like a marathon where you just like train 22 miles and like hope on the day of the race it carries you through 26.2.
Right.
And Lord knows I've never run a marathon, but I've read about it. But he was like, well, what are you worried about? I was like, I'm worried that I'm going to get on stage and sort of lose control and start crying. We're going to be at a bookstore. They're not going to have tissues. Some well-meaning employee is just going to like launch a roll of toilet paper at me and be like, we got you. And like all the social media photos are going to be like me with my book holding a roll of toilet paper and sobbing. And he's like, I'm going to go get some tissues right now.
Problem solved.
Sit in the front row. We will be there for you.
That's
and
so
then
wonderful.
The reaction to people has been really heartening. People really connected with the work and their own experiences in grief. And I had taken such comfort in books written about grief, which will be one of the poems I read later, but Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking, Kevin Young's Dear Darkness, Hope Edelman's Motherless Daughters. And books give you so much. They give you everything that they have in them and ask for nothing back. You know, you can shut them at any time, open them at any time. And it was really cathartic to then be that for other people, to have this book, put it in hands of people, and people bought multiple copies for themselves and for other people who had lost people in their lives. And it gave my writing purpose in the absence of my mother's narration. Mm-hmm. So I'm really grateful for that. It's been a really wonderful experience that I wasn't expecting.
And you don't know. I mean, you don't know when you put something out into the world how it will be received. You can just, you send it out with a hope and a prayer, you know. I'm sure that this book has really touched a lot of people, you know. I feel like you've said a couple of times, you've talked about touring.
Yes.
I think many people would find the idea of a poet touring to be like, very foreign. And I was wondering, you know, I've been thinking about this, knowing that you were going to come into the studio and that we were going to be able to talk. I've been thinking so much about one of the biggest changes that I've seen and experienced since, say, my entry into graduate school at the Michener Center in 2000. is just like the kind of coming together, wonderful coming together. I feel like there used to be performance poetry, and then there used to be academic poetry, and those two were very there was a chasm between them. And I, you know, aside from, what do you think it is that has brought these two? I mean, I didn't actually ever perceive the chasm, but I was always observing it and feeling like, why this difference? And then by the time I was back, I taught a class at UT in the English department and had Michener fellows in the class, and Sam Sachs was in that class. And I just was so heartened by, like, you know, when I was in graduate school, it was academic poetry. There was like this one kind of poetry. Right. And then if you wanted to perform your poetry, it was like, oh, that was in some way.
Right. Like overcompensating for a weakness in the, or just, clownish. Yes.
It was a different thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I was just like, wow, that changed. That was not a very long time period. And so tell me what you think happened there.
I began performing my poetry professionally when I was in my 20s, early 20s. So I started running a poetry slam in New York City out of the basement of CBGB's at the age of 19. And back then we were that was the whole theory of poetry slam, was like, we are taking it directly to the people. We don't care about academia. We don't need your publishing credits. Like, we are creating vital work, telling the stories of our people in our own voices and communicating directly to our communities. And that was, you know, one of the reasons I still find that work electrifying. It's so regional, you know. What is going to win at a poetry slam at the New Rican Poets Cafe may not be the same thing that wins in Omaha, and the same, but each of those people represent something for their community and are so good at communicating that they win. So, and I was very, I wanted publication. So I wanted book publication. I wanted the awards. And I was always banging on grants and residencies. And there was a big gap. And I think a part of it was that students and young people really connected with the work we were creating. We were going to the college campuses, but we were not being brought in by the English departments. We were being brought in by the student unions.
Right.
Or the LGBTQ unions, the African American student councils, who would bring in our poets. And we got paid a lot better than the English departments paid anyway. And, you know, very early on, I would tell people, you know, when you come onto these campuses and you're being brought in by students, reach out to the English departments, reach out to look at their list of professors and find the ones doing modern poetry or African-American lit, and just say, hey, I'm going to be in this, going to be coming to your campus. If your students want to come for extra credit, I'd be happy to talk to them, or, you know, make them aware that we're here, because frequently they're unaware. And I think that as poets began to infiltrate MFA programs, poets, performance poets, and the professors became aware of the work we were doing and how much it was connecting to their students, it became sort of a part of the curriculum, you know. And then as everyone aged up, they sort of merged. And there is incredible success stories. When I was at AWP this year, I was like a proud granny. Like, I kept coming up to people like Franny Choi and Dinez Smith, who host the Poetry Foundation podcast, and have, you know, Dinez was a National Book Award finalist and a Ruth Lilly fellow. Oh my gosh, I applied to Ruth Lilly so many times.
And he had his start in slam poetry?
Yes, yeah, both of them did. Mm-hmm. And then Sam Sachs and Hugh, Hugh Nguyen, who's, you know, got a book coming out in Coffeehouse Press, or just came out and is getting, he was in Entertainment Weekly as a book to read. And these were all people who started out as like young slammers hosting college slams, like doing it in college, graduating to adult, and now having this tremendous success. And I was just saying how proud I was, because to have people like them to look up to when I was a young person would have been transformative to me. You know, so much of my experience coming up as a writer was like forcing myself into places that I didn't think should have let, you know, would let me in. That was, you know, and like speaking of Ruth Lilly, which is a fellowship that the Poetry Foundation put out, before it's like you had to be in a college program in order to even submit. You couldn't just be a working person who was 23 and no matter how many publishing credits you had or accolades you had, you couldn't even apply. And like those boundaries to just access what academia was giving out just seemed impossible to overcome. And now we have this whole generation of incredible writers doing vital work and not shying away. I mean, Sam Sachs is a great example, you know, of someone who, you know, he published a poem in the National Review about being choked by a belt during sex, you know, like he is unafraid to express, you know, who he is in this very vital moment in America and get it into places that for when I was his age felt impossible. So I'm so proud of this generation. And I'm also proud of academia for like embracing what was, you know, the jewels that already existed. And I'm really excited to see where poetry goes in general.
Yeah. I don't know if you see it this way, but just you going through that, the time chronologically, it's also like you then are the poets. You may not have had those poets to look up to, but this generation, that's your legacy. If you're the first wave of these poets. And now I really do. I was just so heartened. It's in it's like fluoride now. It's in the water of I think poetry and even in academia. When I started school, I just felt so out of place. You know, there were people who had put their PhDs at Harvard on hold to come and get their MFA at the Michener Center. And I came from a small town, New Mexico. And, you know, I remember writing, thinking again about it this morning, I remember writing, it was like 3 weeks into school, and writing Naomi Shihab Nye, who was my teacher, and just saying, she was leading the workshop. And I think I was probably like considering just going home. But what I said to her was, I don't know the language that the people are using to talk about poetry.
Yeah.
It is so foreign to me.
Yes.
You know, like I came.
Enjambment and.
it was more just sort of like the, you know, who's writing and who's, you know, you know, who are your predecessors and what, you know, right. Name dropping poets.
Canon,
and very, very academic view, I felt, because my experience with poetry was just like, it was so visceral. I was like, oh yeah, poetry saved my life.
Right.
And now you are talking about it in this way that makes it sound like really boring.
Yes.
And I can't access it. And wrote to her and said, like, I don't know how to access this language. And she wrote back this amazing email that I still, you know, keep to this day that was said, you know, she said, I can finally say that I fully, absolutely understand exactly how you feel. I understand that. And she said that Philip Lopate, the poet, had, you know, talked to her about it in the same way and said, like, there are so many ways of entering into poetry and you have to honor your own way of entering into it. And you can't, you know, and I think I spent so much time, you know, having internalized to me what's just like, it's like very easily just the patriarchy.
Right.
Like, these are the canon. This is the poet. These are the poets who we hold up and these are the poets who we dismiss.
Right.
I mean, the way
and these are the paths you take.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that was just so freeing to me. I was really lucky to have that moment because, and then you just sort of start freeing yourself, you know, more and more.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, I don't have to think like that. I don't have to see that poet as, like, I could just see that poet as I experience them. I don't have to see it the way that whoever is, you know, professor, if you will, you know, is seeing that poet. You know,
yeah.
I think that's really astonishing to me that that's changed so much in such a short time. And it's, I mean, it's heartening in the sense that it really is like examining the people we read and wondering, you know, saying, wait, why are the performance poets outside of academia and we're all, you know, and we're inside the,
right.
What is the difference?
And see. I don't want to blow it up, but oral poetry was the first poetry.
I know, right, exactly. That is something that's really heartening to me. And yeah. It's, I think, something that I didn't see changing. And it's so wonderful, you know, it's just also fun to be part of the change, not be, you know, I think there are still poets out there who are clinging by their fingernails to this idea of who gets to do it.
Right. Yeah, no, that was my, you know, I grew up in working class Philly. My dad worked at the wastewater treatment department. So when I was a kid, I used to say, when you flush your toilet, it goes to my dad. And my mother was like, never describe your life like that. Like, but, you know, I grew up in this neighborhood of like firefighters and cops and city workers. And the idea of being a writer was just, I might as well have told them I wanted to be the tooth fairy. They had no idea how that was ever going to be possible. And every working class family has the same wish for their child, which is to get an education and leave the neighborhood. And so their fear for me was that I would become an artist and go back to poverty that they had just escaped. And so many times I tried to look for role models that had lives that were similar to me, but became successful writers. A lot of them from the, you know, like the 20s and 40s became right. drunks and like died destitute. So that wasn't great. But then there were poets like Jim Daniels, who's a professor at Carnegie Mellon right mm-hmm. now, who paid his way through college by working in auto factories. And he wrote about working in factories, and it spoke to me so profoundly. It's really set the stage for what I think is my writing career. And then you have a poet like Bob Hickok, mm-hmm. who is incredible, has gotten Guggenheims and NEA fellowships. He does not have an MFA. He worked in an auto dye factory, right. creating auto dyes, up until he was hired to become a poetry professor. And his work is incredible. Mm-hmm. And again, like, has a visceral connection to sort of regular working life. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's so important, you know, to visibly see people who have non-traditional backgrounds succeed, so that people who are wondering if they can do it can see a Dinette Smith, can see a Franny Choi, can see a Sam Sachs, and go, even though I feel like this total outlier weirdo who no one's going to want to care about, you know, I see a little bit of myself in this person, and they're making it. Yeah. And people are publishing them and giving them awards, and their books are so vulnerable and raw, and they're able to get that work out there and have people respond to it. So maybe me too. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really proud of this generation for leading the way and showing all of these voices that were traditionally underrepresented. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just a matter of academic versus performance, but right. you know, LGBTQI, HIV positive, mm-hmm. You know, people of color, people, you know, immigrants, like, you know, trans people. Like, there's so many poets who are now being given a platform mm-hmm. That otherwise you had to search them out through their self-published works or through performance poetry channels. You know, we had a lot of people come through that were outside of the mainstream whose work we adored and who got giant audiences, but could never punch through to mainstream. Right. And to see that happen just gives me so much hope about this new generation mm-hmm. that's reading these works and saying, I wonder if I could be a poet, like what they're going to have the freedom to create.
Yeah, right. Yeah. For me, I think when I was, you know, reading poems in college and beyond and wondering if I could follow that path, it was like the poets, like, for me, it was like Sharon Olds, mm. Dorian Locke.
Yeah, yeah.
They seemed to be doing, and I mean, now, you know, they're, you know, I don't think, I mean, well, I think that people still have strong opinions about them or whatever, but I remember, like, early on, like, when the early internet, like, looking up Sharon Olds, and people just, the vitriol that reviewers
right.
slung at her, you know, talking about her body parts. And these are, you can't do this in a poem, you know, basically saying, who the hell do you think you are?
Yes.
And, you know, so it's, yeah, that's just having those voices pull you along, encourage, you know. And so now there are so many voices. There's so many voices being published and being taken seriously on their own grounds, you right. know?
Yeah. And
I mean, maybe Sharon Olds isn't doing what you think a poem does. Maybe it's not what she's doing. It's that it doesn't align with what you think a poem should be doing. And so, you know, right. It's like that, maybe it's not for you.
Well, and one of the gifts of being a woman and an artist is the history of women in the arts, where, no one gets to tell people who history remembers. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Emily Dickinson, you know, obviously well-known poet now, like, you know, died, left all of her poems in a trunk, you know, and now she is this major, you know, figure in American poetry. You have Frida Kahlo, who in her lifetime was known as sort of like the uppity wife of the important Mexican muralist Diego Rivera, and all her like self-portraits were seen as like, ugh, like obscenely
narcissistic.
Right. And then you fast forward and she is the symbol of feminine independence and assertion of will, and she never maybe imagined that in her lifetime. So, I mean, to me, reading these histories and seeing the evolution of these women's art, it just reinforces to me that you just need to create the stuff that feels authentic and important to you, that you feel like, which Sharon Olds clearly does. Mm-hmm. And history will take it from there. Yeah. If you're not recognized in your lifetime, don't sweat it. Mm-hmm. Like, history goes on. And if your work is vital and you're being true to yourself and creating work with that sort of authenticity, you know, it can be rewarded. If you're trying to play into a system, you know, you end up diluting yourself and you may not be as remembered. So, being sort of coming from a poetry slam background and wondering, like, publishing all these books, wondering, like, will anyone remember, is hard. But knowing that generations of women haven't had the opportunity I've had to share my work, and that generations of women artists were never recognized or given a spotlight during their lifetime, but their work is still remembered, and especially by future women, has just helped me stay the course.
Yeah. And you're helping that overarching paradigm shift that I do believe and have faith in, that is happening in publishing in general.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also led by readers. You know, yeah. I think that one of the things that's most surprising to me, it shouldn't be, because I came into poetry when I was a teenager and fell in love with these poets and had my entire brain shaped by the works of the poets that I was exposed to at that age. But poetry is huge among young people right now. It is a major form of expression. They follow things like Button Poetry, which is this enormous YouTube channel that puts out new spoken word poetry pieces on video every day. And they have like millions of hits for works about people, you know, traditionally doing like first person testimonies via poetry about their experiences with like OCD or sexual trauma or, you know, identification, orientation, and kids are gravitating towards these poets, and it's sort of, poetry is almost like perfect for this age because it's 3 minutes or less traditionally, and they can pump themselves up and hear a different perspective or share it. Say like, hey, if you don't think that, you know, that trans women are real women, like, watch this poem for 3 minutes and see if it changes your mind. Right. They can use it as a tool to open up the minds of their professors or their parents or other family members, or say, hey, this is what I feel like sometimes, and I want you to listen to this poet describe it so that we can have a conversation about it. Poetry's become a currency in the internet age, and which I never expected, but I think it's the youth that is really driving the popularity of poetry right now. And I'm grateful to them, that everyone says that, you know, this generation doesn't read, but they just read in a different way.
Yeah, they do. Right. Yeah. So speaking of poems that have like inspired you, or poets that you go back to again and again, do you have, I like to ask poets to bring in a poem. Yes. I mean, there's no better, I just think that's like such a gift to like say, hey, what do you love? Show us what you love. Because there's nothing better than sharing a poem that has changed you with someone else, you know?
Yeah. And I spoke earlier about sort of taking comfort in books about grief.
Right.
And certainly the poet that I'm going to read from, I was an enormous fan of Kevin Young. If you do not know him, he is currently the director of the Schomburg Center in New York City, which is sort of a center of African-American history through the New York Public Library. He's also the editor of The New Yorker, and he's incredible. I mean, he is the most prolific man on earth, mm-hmm. and his books are all incredible. And he wrote a book called Dear Darkness in the mm-hmm. wake of his father's passing, which I turned to so much in the wake of my mother's passing because of the different angles in which he showed the way that grief could arise or that memories could come forth. And so the poem that I'm selecting today from Dear Darkness is a poem called Ode to Sweet Potato Pie. And it's in this last section of the book, which is odes to a whole bunch of different foods from his upbringing. And so my choice today is going to be Kevin Young's Ode to Sweet Potato Pie from his book, Dear Darkness. Caramel, coffee cake, chocolate I don't much love anyway, tough taffy, anything with nuts or raisins, goobers, even my Aunt Dixie's apple pie recipe or the sweet potato pie my mother makes sing, even heaven, even Boston cream pie, key lime, baked Alaska, dense, flourless torte covered in raspberries like a Bronx cheer, sherbet, spelt right, and sandwiches made of ice cream, even mint or coffee I never drink, even sherry and smooth port pulled up from shipwrecks preserved on the bottom of the sea, all of this and more. I would give up to have you here, pumpkin-colored father, cooking for me. Your hungry oven humming. Just one more minute.
Mm. What a beautiful poem, and also just that he's such a brilliant poet. He's incredible too in that, like, the way that he begins the list, this like litany of desserts, and you don't know what they signify yet.
Right.
He's just drawing you along until I would give up all of these. The statement at the end of all of these specific images or, this list of desserts.
Right.
Boom.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
and all these ways it lights up in you, you know, and you know, that's one of his gifts is playing with darkness and light in his book. So, you know, this is called Dear Darkness, and he's grappling with lots of heavy stuff. And then you move into this section about food, and it kind of reminds you of the joy of living, you know, that these things that you love to eat and the community that surrounds eating. And so you get to this place and you're picturing all of this food, and it's like lighting up all of these pleasure centers. And then just to have him be willing to shut all of that down to have one more minute, which is, you know, an experience I think anyone who has lost someone important to them can certainly.
Yeah. Know. And the way that food, you know, especially desserts.
Right.
You know, just it is, those are memory.
Yeah.
Those activate your memory centers as well.
Yeah.
You know.
And there's food lost, yeah. You know, the people mm-hmm. pass too.
Yeah.
You know, right. You have the recipe that you never got down
mm-hmm.
and you never get to have it again.
Right. Yeah. When I smell like really heavy cumin, you know that smell? It's not cumin when it's cooking, but like after you've cooked something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like my grandmother's kitchen. My grandmother actually had a Mexican restaurant, but she and my grandfather both did a lot of like cooking at home. My grandfather would make chicharrones, you know, pigskins.
Yeah.
I still love the smell of them, but you know. You have to like shut off part of your brain to eat them. Don't think about what it is. It reminds me of this poem by Jane Kenyon. Have you read this poem about, I can't now remember what the title is. I teach this poem all the time, but it's like, I took the last dusty piece of china out of the barrel. It was your gravy boat with one hardened brown drop of gravy still on it. I grieved for you then as I never had before. You know, yeah. That sort of, I'm going to bring you in to this poem with the image, with the specificity, and then I'm going to lay the statement on you and I will destroy you.
Yeah, it's true. And that's, you know, Kevin Young also did an incredible anthology called The Art of Losing, which is all poems about
grief. I don't know that anthology.
And, you know, he wrote it because he got married and he realized there's like a bajillion anthologies if you want to do wedding poems, all poems about love that you can buy. And after his father died, and he's a poet, people said, oh, you know, for his funeral, he's like, I've got to find some poems. And he looked for an anthology of poems that would be appropriate to read at a funeral, and none existed. And he thought, this is a travesty. This is people at their worst moments, and we could really be giving them comfort. And it is incredible. And what it does is show that complete spectrum of grief. You know, it's not just poems eulogizing a beloved person, but struggling with anger and guilt and shame and someone you lost a long time ago and are still missing them, and the freshness of just losing somebody and losing someone you never mended with. And it's old poets and new poets, and I highly recommend that. But you know, grief so many facets and rises up in so many different ways that it's really stunning to see a person handle it so well. So Kevin Young with Dear Darkness and his book, A Book of Hours, as well as his anthology, The Art of Losing, I would highly suggest if anyone wants to dive into this territory.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming in, too.
I want to do them all like this. Maybe Rebecca can fly in.
Austin's a great town. You can get a lot of people during book festival.
I know, right? Yeah, we've got to get on that. You can find Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz's poem, The First Checkup After My Mother Died, in her new collection, How to Love the Empty Air, out now from Right Bloody Press. This is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.